hold on to your butts. It's time for a new episode of Destroy All Culture, a sonic death ray from Dimension X that sounds exactly like a weekly podcast hosted by Adam P. Nave and Aiden Morgan. Exposure to Destroy All Culture is 100% fatal, so we put it on the internet. Now listen and die. Lethal effects may take up to 75 years. And here we are with episode 77 of Destroy All Culture with Aiden Morgan and me, Adam P. Nave.
Wow.
Do not take that little pause before your name to mean that I forgot your name. Don't be ridiculous.
I appreciate it.
I would never.
You'd never.
Except for that brief, like, quarter of a second that I totally did. So, what do we want to talk about? I know we have a few things we want to talk about. Where do you want to start?
Well, we could start with Baby Driver.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Very nice. A little bit
I got
of jobs
early today just to make that happen.
Yeah. I knew I was sold on the movie when they started playing John Spencer Blues Explosion at the outset. I'm like, oh, yes, please.
So I got to get one thing out of the way. Because I see no one else on Earth mention it, so I have to be the one. You know how the opening bit in Baby Driver with him being the getaway driver and sing along to the song and all that?
Right.
You know, this is a movie that Edgar Wright has been thinking about for, like, what, 20 years?
Something like that, yeah.
And he did a music video, which was essentially the opening scene to Baby Driver.
Oh.
For a band, like, back in 2003, I want to say. I'm now forgetting the band and the song. But the video is, it has, like, Nick Frost in it and all this, and it's like there's a group of bank robbers who pull into a, you know, a garage, and they're like, and the driver's like, how long will this take? And they're like kind of debating it back and forth, and eventually, like, you know, like 2:54. And they all, and he's like, okay, and then he finds a song, and he's like, all right, 2:54 from now, and hits play, and they all get out of the car, and then he's in the garage singing along with the song, and you know, people come by, and blah, blah, blah. And eventually, like, the end of it is, you know, the alarms go off, they come back out of the car, and he's like, that was more like 3 minutes, and they drive off. And, of course, you know, this is very, very reminiscent of Baby. You can see where he's been playing with this idea forever.
Right.
But I realized something, thinking about all this. Because a lot of people were suddenly going, like, this is so, like, no one had ever thought of doing that. And fuck you, Hudson Hawk.
Oh, of course.
Right, I'm like, Hudson Hawk is the original Let's Time Our Crimes to Music.
Yes. And I've seen it done elsewhere as well. Like, it's just, I can't recall where, but I mean, it's not the first instance of this idea.
Yeah. I just want some love out there for Hudson Hawk.
Understood.
But that aside, this, and I think it was the first thing I said about the movie, was the single most tightly edited and directed thing I think I've ever seen in my life.
I'm with you on that. When you're timing your gunshots to, like, the beats of songs, I mean, that's some pretty tight stuff. I mean, you know how they say that directors and editors often have sort of music at least playing in their heads to, like, time out a scene. Well, Wright was just like, let's just make it obvious. Let's put that in the forefront.
And between the gunshots and, you know, I mean, there's the whole getting coffee scene early on, but it keeps up to the point where, like, there's that dinner scene where near the end, you know, Baby twitches his eyebrow on the beat.
I know.
And so much of that is just editing, not the initial takes, because you can't time that to the initial takes, really?
No.
So, yeah, no, just the neurotic level of editing was just like, we're giant nerds. And I love it. I mean, it bears a rewatch, you know. Because you just, now that you know the plot, you're not like, where's this going? You just want to sit there and just watch all the synchronicities line up.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, it was a better musical than La La Land, I'll say that much.
Well, I still haven't seen La La Land, but from what I hear, not hard. I thought the musical choices were interesting. I mean, there were so many ways to go with this that would have been more popular stuff, or, you know, more stuff in the public consciousness and so on, and no.
No. Yeah, it was sort of like, a lot of it was sort of like an entire album, like an entire soundtrack of deep cuts, basically.
Yeah, which has made it better, you know, because I think, like, when Nowhere to Run comes on, you're almost distracted.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know the song's timing.
Yes.
Not that no one knew any of the songs. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, Nowhere to Run, Radar Love, like, but how many people off the top of their head knew Egyptian reggae? You know, it's one of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I know Egyptian reggae, and you know Egyptian reggae, but I mean, a lot of the people going might not get it. And it's funny, I've been seeing some mixed reviews, or at least some people saying, I don't get it. I was just saying, I don't get the hype. And I'm like, what?
I've seen people who feel that the plot's a little thin, and that's fine. It's like, you know, look, I have a problem occasionally with Del Toro films, because for me, a lot of times with movies, the story, you can have beautiful visuals, but if you don't have enough story there, I'm like, I don't feel like watching an art film right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fair. I mean, and that's the thing. I think if people wanted more of a story and less of what is, for the internal logic, a musical.
Right.
Then this will wobble a little bit for them. But holy shit, this movie is tight as fuck.
Yes, it is.
And it's very much an Edgar Wright film.
Yep. It's his chance to play around in the car chase or the heist movie sandbox.
Right.
Right.
And yeah, like, it's like just dialogue-wise and everything, it's still very much an Edgar Wright film. It's that sort of thing, like, you can spot something that Luc Besson has written from, like, a mile and a half away.
Yes, you can.
Just because there's always, like, a few scenes. They're always there.
Yeah, I think Besson is one of those filmmakers. It's like, give me 50 million dollars, and I will make this bizarre, borderline unwatchable auteurist film full of weird bells and whistles. And it's like, oh, right, you go ahead.
Except they're never borderline. I mean, they're almost never borderline unwatchable. That's the thing. I, you know, because I'm like, Nikita, Leon, Fifth Element, these are eminently watchable films. But I take your meaning. It is that kind of like, I'm going to do that thing I do, and you're just going to sit back and just hand me money for it.
Exactly, yeah. And it's very much that way with the Twin Peaks, The Return. It's
right.
But to a even greater extent, it's just like, you've bought the ticket, and now Lynch is going to do whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't tend to like the auteur theory of film, just because there's so many people, you know, again, like,
yes,
whoever edited this, whose name we don't know, or I don't know, at least, is kind of the unsung hero of the film.
Very much.
The rise of the writer-director, you know, that we're seeing again with things like Lynch and Edgar Wright and Besson and all that, like, when they are doing both jobs, you get way closer to a pure artistic statement. There's one less translation.
Exactly. So I'm just looking up the editor. Doom, doom, doom.
While you do that.
Two editors, Jonathan Amos and Paul Maclis.
Does not surprise me. It took two people.
Yeah, I'm just, Jonathan Amos is familiar. Oh, he's worked a lot with Wright. Scott Pilgrim. Oh, he did Attack the Block. Attack the Block.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so, he seems to have, like, a history on a lot of British television. That's where he got his start. Yeah.
Also important to know for this, given the car chases, is, you know, that Wright insisted that the actors be in the actual cars and not use green screen.
Jeez.
And he talked a lot, too, and used the same rig as George Miller.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he kind of went to the, okay, well, you pulled off Fury Road. Like, how am I going to do this? And it shows. I mean, you know, that whole thing of, like, watching the actors physically move with the movements of the cars, not just kind of faking it.
Right.
Makes a visceral difference.
It really does. Yeah. That's a commitment to verisimilitude there that,
yeah,
you know, could get a person killed, but...
Well, but it's one of those things, I think, that we learn in film again and again and again, and I guess we learn in most mediums of art, that the more computers let us fake things, the more we actually start to look back towards not faking them, because you know, when you first get a new technique and a new technology, you overuse it.
Right.
And this happened in comics with the early days of, I want to say the early days of computer coloring and computer lettering, where people just didn't know how to use the tools. And then you start using the tools, you know, to go, look at all this cool stuff we could do, without stopping to go, maybe we shouldn't? Like, maybe it doesn't work. And then eventually you find a happy medium, you know?
Yeah.
And again, with comics, you never really went back to doing it by hand. Some people do, but for the most part, you don't. it's just the tools adapted to be able to be almost indistinguishable on certain levels.
Right.
And film, you can't yet. Like, some of the stuff can get way closer, but you still need that physicality.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the truth is, if we had to sit down and go and look at films that we praise for their realism but are probably half green screen, we'd be surprised. But at the same time, when especially when you kind of know that there has to be a special effect involved in a shot or a sequence, when you actually have the actors on real sets or in real situations, yeah, there's that little extra nudge of gravity.
Right, and I think, going back to George Miller and Fury Road, I think he found the greatest medium for it, because there was a lot of CG in that film, but no one ever notices it, because it's not the cars, it's not the driving, it's environment.
Yes.
You know, it's adding more dunes, it's sky grading, it's all of that.
Yes.
And because that's it doesn't take away from the weight of the moment.
Right. Yeah, he's not throwing in a bunch of, like, CGI aliens and then having his actors stand around on a green screen and going, oh, alien, look scared.
And a bunch of gophers pop up and go, what? You know, thank you, Indiana Jones 4.
God. not as good a CGI moment as a bunch of, like, tree branches slapping Shia LaBeouf between the legs while he's going, ah.
No, that was practical. That was, they were just like, fuck this.
That was all Shia. He's like, you said they'd be CGI. Stop.
But we never said where.
That's right. There's some clouds in the background where you've CGI'd in. Slap.
Some of these monkeys, they're fake.
But the rabbit ones.
Not actually in the film.
There's somebody who did, like, a video review of that. It might have been Red Letter Media and the you know, the one of the Plinkett type reviews. But they kept on zeroing in on, like, a shot of Ford when somebody says, I thought you were retired, and just cuts to him going, part time, and just looking. And then they point out that in the trailers, they had a different take of the same shot where he's, like, way more sort of on top of it. And somebody says, yeah. I thought you were tired. He's like, part-time, you know, or wherever he does it. But in the movie, they use this, like, impossibly dour sort of, like, part-time shot. And it's,
And I think we both know what happened. It was, like, this is the shot they actually wanted. They wanted that kind of, like, dour, kind of, like, fuck you. Right. And the trailer guys were just like, no.
Sometimes,
we have to make this a little more likable.
Yeah, a little more lifelike. Yeah, I'm sure they put in that shot in the trailer and it's like, part-time. Like, oh, that's not going to work.
Oh, man. But, Baby Driver is one of those movies. It's not that it's hard to talk about, but it's kind of hard to talk about just because it does not make sense as a movie unless you can see it.
I think you're right. I mean, it's hard to say. It's a car chase heist movie with a musical sort of embedded somewhere in it. And I think another part of what makes it work is Ansel Elgort as the title baby. He's kind of an amazing actor. And I just knew him as, like, somebody from, like, some young adult films. But right. He sort of manages to look very young at some moments, sort of awkward and nerdy at others. Like, he's just, like, some points when he's sort of dancing along, you think it's like a kid in his bedroom sort of doing this awkward dance, and suddenly he'll do some sort of, like, little flip or turn. It's like, oh, actually he's, like, an incredibly coordinated dancer.
Right.
And then he'll be like go from stutteringly awkward to like almost like Brando-esque in a moment when he's acting off Lily James's character, who by the way is dating Matt Smith.
All right then.
There you go. I should have brought that out later for a Doctor Who
Yeah,
scene.
that kind of. Well, it was interesting cause when I was watching the trailers. I mean, I wanted to see the movie just because I love Edgar Wright, and I love musicals, and I like car chase movies. So hey, I'm set. But I was just like watching this kid who I didn't really know, you know, and watching him kind of like, okay, well, he's gonna share scenes with like Kevin Spacey and John Hamm doing his like dark John Hamm thing. I was just like, this kid is gonna get lost. And he didn't. So
It's
that's always the
pretty.
mark to me. It's like watching someone, you know, hold their own against people who are known for just taking over scenes
Yeah,
just by
exactly.
accident, you know.
Exactly. And also, like, scenes where he's like, you realize you're going up against, like, Jamie Foxx doing full crazy
Right.
mode. That's, it's tough to, like, get anybody in the theater audience to look at you when you've got, like, Ham and Foxx, sort of squaring off against each other. I'm like, holy crap. Good job.
Yeah,
Good job, young man.
I gotta say, like, as much as I'm not into the like, let's just do sequels and prequels of everything, because the hell with it. I kind of would be really into a John Hamm prequel movie.
Fair enough.
Like, I want to see how that character broke.
If can't remember Jamie Foxx's character's name.
Bats.
Bats, that's it. If Bats, that's a great name.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. There's actually another movie that he's kind of pulling from. Might be Goodfellas for that. But anyway, it would be nice to see just a story like basically like the one that Bats like makes up or
Yeah.
guesses at, sort of as like Ham's character is a Wall Street broker who went a bit nuts, went a bit off the rails,
Had a
and
drug
now is
problem and is now this guy. Yeah.
It's I'm up for that.
Yeah, I just again I like John Hamm. I think he has way more range than he's often been allowed to play with. Not that things like Don Draper didn't have range, but just he has way more under the hood than that, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's really good at. I mean, he's always been good with Mad Men, but he's all. But the fact once you started seeing him in comedies, like I remember he was in like for example 30 Rock or on showed up on SNL,
Right.
and I was like, oh, he can. He has like a whole other dimension where he's able to sort of play off his own image, like just almost like this pitch perfect sort of self-awareness. It's like,
Yeah, it's that
okay,
Clooney thing.
yes, exactly.
And I want him to get, I mean, this is kind of a Clooney role, frankly. Like, you could see Clooney in this 10 years ago. And so I keep hoping, like, John Hamm kind of gets that same career and just kind of takes off the way Clooney did with that. Like, he could just chameleon himself into whatever emotional state you need, but he's just charismatic enough that you're along for the ride. You know, Michael Clayton, for instance, like the one of my favorite Clooney movies. I mean, just a fantastic movie without Clooney, but you know, Clooney really, really sells the last inches of it. It's like I could see him doing that role. You know, it's like Ocean's 11. Like, there are very few Clooney movies I couldn't actually sub Ham in for and be like, that wouldn't work.
I agree.
So
By the way,
yeah, hopefully Ham gets way more. Yeah.
the Clooney Ham thing works really well, but I just did a little mental exercise in my head, and you cannot sub out John Hamm for John Krasinski.
No.
That doesn't work.
That does not work. Although no, I kind of want to see an Ocean's 11 remake with John Hamm and Clooney's character and Kevin Spacey as Brad Pitt's character. Because I think it would not only work, it would be surreal.
It definitely would. So there's one thing we mentioned with that you weren't quite sold on. It's because
Oh
you
yeah.
mentioned Kevin Spacey. You weren't quite sold on Spacey's or Doc's sort of transition or his sudden willingness to
Like I said, I can
basically
get there.
sacrifice himself.
I can get there. And it's the musical rules. And it's one of those things that, like, you see it throughout that, like, you know, there is this kind of weird guilt he feels because he honestly does consider, you know, early on at least, like, maybe his good luck charm, that he's actually helping the kid. He's giving the kid some direction.
Mm-hmm.
And why isn't this kid grateful?
Right.
And I think that kind of wounds him a little bit. And then he sees, like, oh, no, this kid's grown up. Like, when he insists, like, he makes the call because he's part of this. He's allowing him to grow up. And part of that growing up is he comes at you hard. It's like, you got to respect it. And so I can get there. I can get to the turn, but it's an awkward get. It's not a natural through line.
Yeah. It was probably the hardest sell of the whole movie. So
yeah.
Yeah.
There's like a scene or two that would have done it. Like, that's all it needs. It's just like, you know, seven lines of dialogue type of thing is all that separates that from being an easy sell to a hard sell.
Right. Yeah.
And again, if that's the biggest problem with your fucking movie, well done.
Exactly. Also, I want to go back in time and be there for the casting meeting when they said, hey, who shall we get to play the dead mother? I know, Sky Ferreira. I still say, I'm like, what the fuck? I mean, it was just, if I didn't know who she was, it would be fine. But knowing that was Sky Ferreira in that role, I'm like, that is just bizarre.
Well, I mean, again, you want someone who can actually sing.
Mm-hmm.
And you want someone who shares that same sort of almost weird childlike innocence that isn't.
Yeah.
That you know, Angor has. And so I think they ended up with the right choice.
Yeah,
but
well,
I agree.
So.
Like, on paper, you're just like, wait, what? Really?
Yeah. But as it turned out, it seemed to work out well. Because, I mean, and also, I mean, you kind of had to have her in flashbacks because, to me, she always looks, but she, like, her look is very strange. Like, she has a very unorthodox, I think she's pretty, but very unorthodox face. And if the camera rests on it too long, it just sucks all the attention away from everything else. I find, because Ferreira's face is so odd. And so to have her sort of like in flashback, it's like, it's where her, sort of her face can make a big impression, but not have to share screen time with, like, the main cast. I thought that was worked really well. I thought that was a good choice.
Yeah, no, I think she was a good choice for it overall. Yeah.
And again,
not what you think.
Easy. No, again, what you think, yeah.
So, anyway, moving on.
Moving on.
As is our wont.
Yes. Oh, I'll bring in my segue now. Hey, yeah. Did you know that Lily James is dating Matt Smith?
Very well done.
Speaking of Doctor Who. Now let's talk about Killjoys. No, let's talk about Doctor Who.
So Doctor Who happened.
It did.
I'm going to be honest with you here. Now, I ended up liking the episode more than I didn't. I kind of want to desperately see it again.
Mm.
But the first time I watched it, I kind of felt bored. It was a longer episode, and about like more than halfway through, I just found myself kind of like, okay, let's wrap this up a little bit. I don't know why. It was just like it. There was something about the first, I don't know, 30 odd minutes of that episode where they were just getting to where they needed to go that were full of great moments, but overall just lacked the momentum.
Yeah, I think, well, it's funny because you say the first 30 minutes because I watched it in two installments. And the first installment was I hit the 30 minute mark and I said, I think I can like stop here.
Right.
And come back to this tomorrow, which is what I did. But it seemed like a natural point because things were kind of slow, and I thought, well, they're gearing up for something, so I'll come back for the gear up bit and when I'm more awake.
Yeah, it's like I feel like the two episodes could have been one longer episode and cut about 30 minutes out of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yep, I know exactly what you mean.
But for all that, it was a good episode.
It was. I thought they did justice to all the various characters. The I mean, I did like, I really like the fact that we don't see the Doctor regenerate, that he meets up with the original Doctor, and then presumably they're going to have an adventure in the Christmas special.
Well, because if they're both at the point of regeneration, which
right.
they are,
yes,
then it kind of becomes, you know, the newest version of the Doctor, who is the first one since the first Doctor mm-hmm. to actually sort of accept who he is fully.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't want to change. Neither did the first Doctor. So
right.
I think thematically it works. I don't know. The Bill stuff, I was happy that he didn't, that Moffat didn't just go, like, the hell with this. But the resolution was kind of, oh, by the way, this.
Right.
He fairy-tailed his way out of the end of that episode. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. Did he? It was like, hey, remember the first episode? Remember the first episode of this season? I kind of do, so here you go.
Right, and now they can just transfer anywhere, and it doesn't matter about the time problem, and we're not going to actually fix anything or save Nardole. Just fuck it, we're gone.
Yeah.
It was just a little bit rushed.
Perhaps so. I mean, it's funny to say, considering that, like, you know, you had an extra long episode, and you basically, you know, finished Bill's arc by, like, paying off something from, like, you know, the first episode of the season. But yeah, it's at the same time, it just kind of felt like, hello, here I am. Come to save you.
Yeah, it was a little off. It was still good. I still like it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of fun to be had, by the way, if you didn't play this game in your head, if you go back and ever rewatch it, play this game, of try to imagine, you know, Bill seeing herself as still Bill.
Right.
Try to imagine all of her Bill lines being spoken in the Cyberman voice.
I did that.
Yeah, okay. What, yeah. Just me? Because...
Yes. You can't really do that while the episode plays, but otherwise it ruins everything.
Also, I really do long to return to Davey's version of the sonic screwdriver and not this thing that can just cause the ground to explode.
Right. I mean, they explained it all, but it was still like, it just boom, boom. Yeah. That was a little silly.
Yeah.
Also, I don't really like the sonic screwdriver, because it looks like a little miniature TARDIS, and I'm like, it just feels a little on the nose.
It's very toyetic.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It's very obviously the screwdriver they built to be a toy.
Yes.
Which is interesting, given that it was given to the Doctor, who is supposed to be the one who is moving away from that.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's like, here you have the mighty hand of the BBC. but we'll probably get a new one soon enough anyway.
Exactly. So, unless it's like a little actual mini fig of the Doctor.
That would be amazing.
That would be really funny. It would be like a tiny little homunculus that sort of points at things.
You know, or again, like, the first Doctor didn't even have a Sonic. Like, we didn't get the Sonic to the fourth Doctor, so...
That's right.
I don't know. There are, of course, rumors about the new season after the Christmas special being more like one big 12-part story. Which, I don't know. We'll see. I try not to judge new Doctor Who seasons with a new, you know, with a new showrunner.
Yeah.
Just because there's no way to tell what they're going to do when they actually get in the chair.
Exactly. I am looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Is it Chris Chibnall? That's going to be the new showrunner. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, apparently the third season of Broadchurch has gotten much better. So that's, you know, from, 'cause the second season was really bad. I couldn't even make my way. Even the first season was beginning to get dogged by, like, sort of sentimentality and such. And the second season, I was like, I just know this is now a bad show. But season three, well worth watching.
Well, there you go. I mean, yeah, we'll see what happens. I think this, you know, I think the Christmas special is going to be interesting, given everything. I will say also, I like the whole Missy Master thing. Just
oh,
the creepiness,
yes.
And just how, like, bizarre and fucked up that was.
Yes.
Straight to the end was kind of perfect. And it's the Master. I mean, how many times have we had The, well, he didn't regenerate, he's dead.
Exactly. No, they'll find a way. They'll find some way to
They
bring
don't
the
even
master
need to.
back. Yeah.
You just have them show up and you're done.
Yep. Explain nothing, just here I am.
That's what they did to bring Sims back, frankly.
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
You're right, it makes no sense.
But it doesn't matter. It's the master. He gets to make no sense. Or she gets to make no sense. You know, whatever.
Yeah. I'd actually forgotten how much I enjoyed John Sims' version of the master.
Mm.
Especially the full-on crazy sort of like consumed by sort of self-loathing, you know, loathing for himself and for the doctor at the same time, and the way they brought that back, it's like I will literally kill myself before I let myself self stand with a doctor. Like,
but
wow.
Also to be fair, like the last time we saw him really as a doctor, he was, you know, superpowers and turning into a skeleton. It was not the best thing.
Yeah,
you know, the first part of that was like, oh, we want to forget this.
Exactly. Yeah, the skeleton running around and eating people thing was a little. That's not the greatest character note for the master.
Yeah. But no, Capaldi. You know, he had a rough first season, like many doctors do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know the last couple seasons. I don't know if you can hear this cat.
It was like, it's like the that faint cat sound that might be a door opening, but might be a cat.
Yeah, no, this is because I have, because Laszlo isn't here right now, I have my office door open when I'm recording, which I never do and shouldn't have done, because it means that Watson at least will bring his ball to be thrown, and he just carries it through the house, like, in his mouth, meowing around it.
Yeah, we have cats that do the same.
Yes.
The
and
same
then he plays
string.
Fetch with me.
Oh.
So he just keeps bringing it back. And I can't reach the door to close it because of headphones. It's the last two seasons. It's really been a great doctor.
It really has. And some of the best episodes of the entire series have been on Capaldi's run. So yeah, it's, and I guess I'm not as excited about Doctor Who as once I was. I just think because the show's now been around for 12 years.
We've been spoiled. We've gotten used to it.
Exactly. And we're older. We're more demanding. But there's been some pretty remarkable stuff under his run. So I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. You know, and we'll see who the new Doctor is and how they do. And I don't know.
We shall see.
Yeah.
And did you know that Lily James is dating Matt Smith?
I've heard.
Speaking of Killjoys.
Wow. Okay.
My segues just keep getting worse.
It's just the one is the problem.
My segue gets increasingly less applicable.
Oh, dear God. So Killjoys is back.
Killjoys is definitely back. Unless you have anything else to add about.
No, I'm good. We're just so listeners know, it's like, you know, you're a little out of it today. I'm very out of it today myself. I've been writing a whole lot of prose over the last couple of days and doing nothing else. Like, I haven't.
Oh right, yeah.
I've like barely been like, you know, remembering to like eat. It's just I've just been hammering. So I'm a little spaced. So you know, we're trying to make this work. Killjoys, everyone. So they didn't change the music or the title cards?
Yeah, I thought because they broke into like some music at a couple points, I thought, oh, new credits. Nope.
It's not the show. And that's okay. Yeah, I'm still not as I still like the original one better. That's me.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy that hoo-hoo thing. I mean, it's I always like that sort of thing, but but it's not quite as catchy for
right and it whatever. But no, the new season, we're back and things have gotten fucked up again because it's Killjoys. You know, I do like the weird, not weird, the Dutch growth.
Mm-hmm.
that now that Klein is gone, she is kind of not afraid and not searching for things. She's kind of accepting that this is who she is.
Yes.
And, you know, now she'd like a war, please.
Yeah, it's like, well, we killed a bunch of Hullen, and now let's go get the take care of the rest of them. I think,
yeah,
is the mission for the season. Yeah, I don't have, to be honest, I don't have a whole lot to say about this episode. Other than that, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean the dialogue was possibly sharper than ever, which is always a treat.
Mm-hmm.
I really did like the mirrored calls, like the recorded messages between Dutch and Johnny.
Yes.
And that, like, obviously Dutch has watched that one enough that she now replies to it and has an entire conversation built up in her head around the spaces, which was a great fake out and also just says so much about the character.
Precisely. I don't think I've ever seen a show that puts so much stock in what is essentially a platonic love story.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
It really is. If people say what's so great about Killjoys, it's stuff like that.
Yeah.
That just does just things differently, just looks at relationships and characters in different ways and isn't afraid to say there are different ways of relating and building friendship in a show. And so it's right. Fantastic.
You know, the whole Where is Clara thing, I do wonder if it's just part of that is the actress's availability.
I thought maybe. Because I thought to myself, this episode could have worked with that actor in place anyway. Because they had somebody with her arm. So I have a feeling like the script at one time had Clara. And then she was like, nope, sorry. And then they had to sort of make changes here and there.
Right. I mean, I think they'll end up stronger for it, but
I agree.
But that, yeah, that did throw me a little bit at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It felt a little bit like a workaround at some points, but I mean, hey, maybe not. Maybe it's all part of the plan.
You know, also the subtle and not so subtle changes to John in this are interesting as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in the first season, we have his whole, like, his hero complex, where it's like, okay, well, he get his ear cut off, you know, whatever it takes. And you kind of see that replicated here with the Hackmon thing. But then, you know, season one, Giant Jacoby does not walk into a room and blow someone's head off.
Right.
Like, he's been a little more broken.
That's... That's character growth of a sort.
It is.
Also, I love the fact that his chosen mod is essentially a laser middle finger.
You caught the name of it, right?
I didn't.
Oh, dear God. Yeah, no, when he's like, and they're like, oh, it's a good choice and all this, and they mentioned like, all right, well, you know, ready, the finger banger.
That's right.
And I was just like, come on, just... Now you're just trying to see what you can get away with saying. And of course, you know, Tom Allison as Pre with his, this better be worth the chafing.
That's pretty good. Yeah, it was one of those episodes where everybody, like, it takes time with the core characters, and then, but everybody gets something.
Yeah. And again, the core characters now not only, you know, are Aldous, but also Fancy is back on their side.
That's pretty good. I like having Aldous back. That's for some reason I really like the way they took Aldous and started as like just this stock sort of authoritarian figure who's like maybe a threat, maybe an ally. It's good. It's like
one of the monks, and then they've kind of made him, well, like with Pri, they all of these people have really fucked up pasts, and we're going to play with that.
Exactly. That's.
I also did like that we get the return of Fancy's unnecessarily like complex toys. Because you remember the first season when we first seen like that was his whole thing,
right?
Was like instead of partners, he's just teched himself out to not need them.
Oh, all tons of fun.
Including, of course, the end "what the fuck" moment with Davin, which is one of these "this is going somewhere strange and probably not where any of us think it is."
Yes.
I did wonder, like, the whole, like, "oh, okay, we're going to stab all the Holland and all this." Can he no longer control the, like, was the goo he could control only that?
Only that, that goo, specific? Only that branch of goo?
Right.
Good question.
And my guess is yes. Because otherwise he would have just been exploding heads.
Yes.
While declaring himself a wizard. This stupid show, I love it so much.
Oh, yeah. Also, Turin, I'm glad to see Turin is in the mix still.
Yeah, no, Turin, you know, I did not like the character until near the end of the first season.
No, well, he was unlikable. Then all of a sudden, he has a turn where he becomes sort
right,
of...
Right, yeah, he suddenly has a character.
Yeah.
Past just Stern.
Exactly.
But, you know, he's still vaguely not liked, you know, to the... What was that? Oh, God, the great devil. Don't take your haircut out on me. Which was great, because if you notice, they cut the turn and he actually has had a haircut since the last season. And the actor just shoots this look of maybe he didn't like it. Like, it was just enough to make me go, I wonder just how bitchy that was actually meant to be.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I have not seen anything else, you know, no Killjoys or Winona, no Winona Earp or Orphan Black or anything yet.
I haven't seen the most recent Orphan Black, but if the one, the episode 3, yeah, is actually one of my favorites, mostly because it's centered on Allison.
Oh yeah, no, Allison is the secret weapon of that show.
Yeah, and it's Allison and Donnie mostly, and it's them sort of, and it's Allison sort of figuring out how to sort of get one over on Rachel.
And there's no one else has done.
Exactly. And there's that moment when they say, and she's, Rachel says to her, "oh, we finally meet." I'm like, what the, these two characters have never met?
One of the great problems with Orphan Black is the, because of, I mean, just partially money, but, and just the physicality of it, is that some of the side characters don't really meet, and that of all the characters, I think Allison always gets the shortest shift.
Yeah.
Well, and that's sad.
I mean, and it's sort of that episode 3 kind of even addresses this head on when basically one of the Neolutionists says to her, you know, you're the least useful.
Right.
It's like, we're not killing you as a courtesy, just don't get in our way. And it's like, that's cold. But, and then this was about her saying, yes, I am useful. I can hold my own.
Yeah, no, in ways that no one else around her thinks she can. And that's...
Right.
And again, with the standard, like, because they are all the same person on some level, you know, seeing those shades of the other characters in her that everyone else seems to ignore. Because, well, she's just the housewife. It's like, oh no, don't mess with her.
Yeah.
Like, she's also the one who has bodies buried in her basement. None of y'all do. So, I think it's like, it kind of like, you know, Helena has the largest body count of anyone on the show, but then it becomes Allison. And they seem to forget that.
Yeah. And if I recall, there's like a whole episode where she, like, tortured Donnie with craft supplies.
Right.
Which I have to say was a TV Hall of Fame moment. It was just so absurd.
You know, I'm sure that they're going to do spotlight episodes over however many episodes they have. Was it like 10?
Yeah, something like that. 10 to 13. I can't remember the season order. But yeah, so they've only got, geez, there were now 4 episodes in, so we don't have, we're running out of Orphan Black.
Yeah, no, it's only 10 episodes. It's 10 episodes a season. So, yeah, no, we're almost at the halfway point. And again, I'm sure that there will be spotlight episodes coming up for, you know, everyone else who needs one.
Right.
And I only say that because I'm not sure that Sarah needs one.
No, because the show is kind of a Sarah's episode.
Right. I mean, Cosima kind of needs one, but not really. You know, and we're going to have, I'm sure we're going to have a Helena catch-up episode that'll be fucked up, but...
Oh, yeah.
But for all that, like, yeah, we're running out of show, and I'm just glad that we got an Allison episode, and also an Allison, but that had weird callbacks all the way at the beginning of the show, you know, Felix painting.
Yes. It's like, why are you painting naked? It's part of my process.
Yeah.
All very music. Yeah, actually, because I mean, part of the reason that one of the things that I think this season is doing very right is sort of backing away from some of the really convoluted aspects of the storytelling. So the stuff that actually made me kind of tired of it by season four. Right. Although I have to say the way they dispatched. MK, the clone introduced last season, was a really brutal scene. I don't know if you saw that bit. But,
oh, I did, and I'm not sure how I really feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get it. That it was just kind of one character too many, and she's kind of Cosima by way of Helena in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And she also makes things too easy.
Yeah.
But it was just tonally for that show, it was way off.
Exactly. It was just not something I expected to see from Orphan Black. I was like, this is odd. I mean, I suppose if you're going to have James Frayne in the show, you have to let him be sort of horrifically unpleasant and psychopathic. So,
but you can do that without this.
Without having him stomp someone to death. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, we didn't really need. I don't know. It was a weird little. It felt like season one, when they hadn't quite figured out some of the tone of the show.
Yeah. That makes sense. It was a callback to season one in the bad way.
Yes.
But that's also, of course. Exactly. Now that it's season five, like, they have to be raising the stakes, and what better way to raise the stakes than kill off a character? Which is, I don't know, it seems like a go-to for shows these days. Let's kill someone. But at least Maslany isn't, like, losing a paycheck. You can kill her repeatedly, and she'll be like, I'm still here.
I am trying to figure out the who will survive, who will not of the show.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that it's, you know, Helena and Allison, basically.
You mean the ones who will survive?
Yes.
Good, okay.
You know, Sarah will sacrifice herself for something.
Mm-hmm. Probably to keep Kira.
Probably Kira.
Yeah.
Right. And Cosima will sacrifice herself for some sort of cure thing. You know, Rachel doesn't make it out alive, that's obvious.
Right. Yeah, when I heard actually in episode two that a character had died, one of the clones, I'm like, oh, okay, it's Rachel. But no, turns out no. No, Rachel can't make it through. But yeah, Helena and Allison definitely are on the list of the survivors list. It might just be Rachel and Sarah. Those are the ones I see are most. Definitely up for death, because Rachel's essentially a villain, needs to go, and Sarah needs to sacrifice herself to be the hero. So,
the way Beth did, except correctly. Beth,
yeah, except not just walk in front of a train.
Right, not selfishly this time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I think it'll be.
I guess August.
I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about you. I'm thinking we're kind of close to the hour mark. We should just kill it for today.
Yeah,
we're
sure.
Both out of it.
We are a little out of it, but still good conversation. But yeah.
Yeah. we'll cue some music that is not the Bell Bottoms and
Bell Bottoms.
And we'll do this again, I believe, next week.
Hey, did you know that Lily James is dating Matt Smith?
Really? I had not heard.
Music, music. Thank you.